Rule 2. Imagine who you could be, and then aim single-mindedly at that. Who are you, and who could you be? How do you know who you are? After all, you are complex beyond your own understanding. More complex than anything else that exists, excepting other people. Complex beyond belief. And your ignorance is further complicated by the intermingling of who you are with who you could be. You are not only something that is, you are something that is becoming. And the potential extent of that becoming also transcends your understanding. Everyone has the sense, I believe, that there is more to them than they have yet allowed to be realized. That potential is often obscured by poor health, misfortune, and the general tragedies and mishaps of life. But it can also be hidden by an unwillingness to take full advantage of the opportunities that life offers, abetted by regrettable errors of all sorts, including failures of discipline, faith, imagination, and commitment. Who are you? And, more importantly, who could you be if you were everything you could conceivably be? Are such questions impossible to answer? Or are there sources available to us from which guidance might be derived? After all, we have been observing ourselves behave in our successes and failures for tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years. During that time, our shamans, prophets, mystics, artists, poets, and bards have distilled something vital from such observations, some concentrated essence of what makes us human in actuality and possibility. In doing so, they have provided us with representations of that vital essence, presenting itself to us as that which can be neither ignored nor forgotten. Those creative people write and act out the dramas and tell us the stories that capture our imagination, and they fill our dreams with visions of what might be. The deepest and most profound of these are remembered, discussed, and otherwise honed collectively, and made the focus of rituals that unite us across the centuries, forming the very basis of our cultures. These are the stories upon which the ritual, religious, and philosophical edifices characterizing sophisticated, populous, successful societies are built. The stories we can neither ignore nor forget are unforgettable for this reason, among others. They speak to something we know, but do not know that we know. The ancient Greek philosopher Socrates believed that all learning was a form of remembering. Socrates posited that the soul, immortal in its essence, knew everything before it was born anew as an infant. However, at the point of birth, all previous knowledge was forgotten and had to be recalled through the experiences of life. There is much to be said for this hypothesis, strange as it might now appear. There is much that we could do, much that our bodies and minds are capable of doing, that remains dormant right down to the genetic level. Exposure to new experience activates this dormant potential, releasing abilities built into us over the vast span of our evolutionary history. This is perhaps the most basic manner in which our bodies retain past wisdom and draw upon it when necessary. It is in this way, although not only in this way, that human possibility exists. Thus, there is something profound to be said for the concept of learning as remembering. Obviously, as well as remembering, as in the turning on of innate but hidden possibilities, we can learn much that is new. This is one of the primary factors differentiating us from animals. Even complex and intelligent mammals, such as chimpanzees and dolphins, tend to repeat their species-typical behaviors generation after generation, with very little change. Humans, by contrast, can and continually do seek out and encounter what is new, investigate and adapt to it, and make it part of themselves. We can, as well, translate something we already know at one level of representation into knowledge at another. We can watch the actions of a living creature, animal or human, and then imitate them, translating our perceptions of their movement into new movements of our own. We can even generalize such imitative acts, catching the spirit of what or whom we are observing, and producing new ways of seeing and acting that are in some manner similar to that spirit. Consider the professional impersonator. He or she doesn't necessarily copy the precise behaviors, movement for movement, of those being impersonated, but the spirit, what's common across all the behaviors of the target celebrity. The same is true when children play at being adults. It's the spirit they're after, not the individual behaviors. This is part of what makes up the basis of the deeply embodied implicit knowledge that forms so much of the basis of our true understanding. We can also observe someone act or something occur and write down what we see, translating action into language that outlasts its utterance, and then communicate it later in the absence of what or whom is being described. Finally, and most mysteriously, we can imagine and then act out something that has simply not been seen before, something that is truly original. And we can code and represent all that ability, adaptive action and its transformation, in the stories we tell about those we admire as well as those we hate. And that is how we determine who we are and who we could perhaps become. Stories become unforgettable when they communicate sophisticated modes of being, complex problems and equally complex solutions that we perceive consciously in pieces but cannot fully articulate. It was for this reason, for example, that the biblical story of Moses and the Israelites' exodus from Egypt became such a powerful touchstone for black slaves seeking emancipation in the United States. "Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaoh to let my people go." The biblical story of Exodus is properly regarded as archetypal, or paradigmatic, or foundational by psychoanalytic and religious thinkers alike because it presents an example of psychological and social transformation that cannot be improved upon. It emerged as a product of imagination and has been transformed by constant collective retelling and reworking into an ultimately meaningful form that applies politically, economically, historically, personally, and spiritually, all at the same time. This is the very definition of literary depth, something that reaches its apogee in certain forms of ancient, traditional stories. The fact of that depth means that such accounts can be used diversely as a meaningful frame for any process of profound change experienced by any individual or society. Stable state, descent into chaos, re-establishment of stability, and can lend that process multidimensional reality, context, powerful meaning, and motivation. The emergence of the unforgettable. How might an unforgettable story come to be? What might precede its revelation? It is, at the very least, the consequence of a long period of observation. Imagine a scientist monitoring the behavior of a wolf pack or a troop of chimps, indeed any group of complex social animals. He or she attempts to identify regularities in the behavior of the individuals and the group, patterns in a word, and to articulate those regularities, to encapsulate them in language. The scientist might first relate a series of anecdotes about animal actions emblematic of the general behavior of the species. He or she might then abstract even further, attempting to generalize across anecdotes with rule-like descriptions. I say rule-like because the animals are not following rules. Rules require language. Animals are merely acting out regularities. They cannot formulate, understand, or follow rules. But human beings? We can observe ourselves acting as a scientist might, more accurately, as a storyteller might. Then we can tell the stories to each other. The stories are already distillations of observed behavior. If they are not distillations, they will not be interesting. Relating a sequence of everyday actions does not make for a good story. Once the story is established, we can analyze it, looking for deeper patterns and regularities. If that analysis is successful, we can generalize across anecdotes with the formulation of rules. And then we can learn consciously to follow those rules. Here is how this might happen. We all react judgmentally when a child or adult, or indeed a society, is acting improperly, unfairly, or badly. The error strikes us emotionally. We intuit that a pattern upon which individual and social adaptation depends has been disrupted and violated. We are annoyed, frustrated, hurt, or grief-stricken at the betrayal. This does not mean that each of us, reacting emotionally, has been successful at articulating a comprehensive philosophy of good and evil. We may never put our finger on what has gone wrong. However, like children unfamiliar with a new game, but still able to play it, we know that the rules are being broken. Something precisely like this is portrayed in the biblical story of Exodus, the ancient account of the flight of the Hebrew slaves from their Egyptian masters. Moses, who leads the escaping people, is continually called upon by his followers to draw very fine moral distinctions when they struggle with one another and seek his advice. In consequence, he spends a very long time observing and contemplating their behavior. It is as if the desert prophet had to discover what rules he and his Israelite followers were already struggling to act out prior to his receipt of the explicit commandments from God. Remember, every society is already characterized by patterned behavior, otherwise it would be pure conflict and no society at all. But the mere fact that social order reigns to some degree does not mean that a given society has come to explicitly understand its own behavior, its own moral code. It is therefore no accident that in this story, Moses serves as a judge for his followers, and does so with sufficient duration and intensity to exhaust himself before he receives the Ten Commandments. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, "What is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning until even?" And Moses said unto his father-in-law, "Because the people come unto me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws." And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, "The thing that thou doest is not good. Thou wilt surely wear away, both thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone." Exodus 18:13-18. This difficult exercise in discrimination and judgment, observing and weighing, is an integral part of what prepared the biblical patriarch for the receipt of divine revelation. If there had been no behavioral base for those rules, no historical precedent codified in traditional ethics, no conventions, and no endless hours of observation of the moral patterns, the commandments simply could not have been understood and communicated, much less obeyed. An unforgettable story captures the essence of humanity and distills, communicates, and clarifies it, bringing what we are and what we should be into focus. It speaks to us, motivating the attention that inspires us to imitate. We learn to see and act in the manner of the heroes of the stories that captivate us. These stories call to capacities that lie deep within our nature, but might still never develop without that call. We are dormant adventurers, lovers, leaders, artists, and rebels, but need to discover that we are all those things by seeing the reflection of such patterns in dramatic and literary form. That is part of being a creature that is part nature and part culture. An unforgettable story advances our capacity to understand our behavior beyond habit and expectation toward an imaginative and then verbalized understanding. Such a story presents us in the most compelling manner with the ultimate adventure, the divine romance, and the eternal battle between good and evil. All this helps us clarify our understanding of moral and immoral attitude and action, personal and social. This can be seen everywhere and always. Question: who are you? Or, at least, who could you be? Answer: part of the eternal force that constantly confronts the terrible unknown voluntarily. Part of the eternal force that transcends naivete and becomes dangerous enough in a controlled manner to understand evil and beard it in its lair. And part of the eternal force that faces chaos and turns it into productive order, or that takes order that has become too restrictive, reduces it to chaos, and renders it productive once again. And all of this, being very difficult to understand consciously, but vital to our survival, is transmitted in the form of the stories that we cannot help but attend to. And it is in this manner that we come to apprehend what is of value, what we should aim at, and what we could be. Materia Prima, Who You Could Be, Part 1. I would like to try my hand at explaining the meaning of the illustration based on an ancient alchemical woodcut that opens this chapter. Describing what it signifies reveals how much information can be contained within an image without the viewer possessing any explicit understanding of its contents. Such a picture is in fact better considered an early stage in the process by which such explicit understanding develops. The ancient alchemist who produced the picture was dreaming, in a very real sense, while doing so, dreaming about what a person could be and how that might come about. At the very base of the image is a winged sphere. Atop that perches a dragon. Standing on the dragon is a two-headed human figure, one head male, the other female. The male head is associated with an image of the sun, the female with the moon. In between, but also above the two heads, is the symbol for Mercury, god, planet, and metal simultaneously. A variety of additional symbols round out the picture. Everything portrayed is enveloped in an egg-shaped container. This arrangement indicates that the image is of many things inside one thing, a multiplicity and a unity, just as an unhatched chick is encapsulated within a single container, but is many increasingly differentiated and complex biological parts, particularly in its later stages of development. In its entirety, the image is labeled materia prima, Latin for the primal element. The alchemists regarded the materia prima as the fundamental substance from which everything else, matter and spirit included equally, emerged or was derived. You can profitably consider that primal element the potential we face when we confront the future, including our future selves, or the potential we cannot help upbraiding ourselves and others for wasting. It can also be usefully conceptualized as the information from which we build ourselves and the world, instead of the matter out of which we generally consider reality composed. Each interpretation, potential and information, has its advantages. What does it mean that the world can be usefully considered as potential or information? Think about what happens, for example, when you stop by the mailbox and pick up your mail. Consider as well what that mail is made of. Materially speaking, it's merely paper and ink. But that material substrate is essentially irrelevant. It would not matter if the message was delivered by email or voice, or in Morse code for that matter. What is relevant is the content, and that means that each piece of mail is a container of content, of potential or information, positive, neutral, or negative. Maybe, for example, it is a notification of investigation from your country's tax department. This means that, despite its apparently harmless presence in your hand, the letter is tightly and inextricably connected to a gigantic, complex, and oft arbitrary structure that may well not have your best interests in mind. Alternatively, perhaps it is something joyful, such as an unexpected letter from someone loved or a long-awaited check. From such a perspective, an envelope is a container, a mysterious container, at least in potential, from which an entire new world might emerge. Everyone understands this idea, even if they do not know it. If you have been having trouble with the tax authorities, for example, and you receive an official piece of mail from their agency, your blood pressure will increase or drop precipitously. Your heart will pound, your palms will sweat, and a feeling of intense fear, even doom, may sweep over you. That is the instinctive response associated with preparation for action that accompanies exposure to danger. And now you will have to decide, are you going to open the letter and face what is inside? And having done so, are you going to think your way through the problem, terrible as that might be, and begin to address it? Or are you going to ignore what you know, pretend that everything is all right, even though you know emotionally, as a consequence of your anxiety, that it is not, and pay the inevitable psychological and physical price? It is the former route that will require you to voluntarily confront what you were afraid of, the terrible abstract monster, and hypothetically to become stronger and more integrated as a result. It is the latter route that will leave the problem in its monstrous form and force you to suffer like a scared animal confronted by a predator's vicious eyes in the pitch of night. A winged sphere, inscribed with a square, a triangle, and the numerals 3 and 4, occupies the bottom third of the image in question. This singular entity or object was known by the alchemists as the round chaos. It is a container, the initial container of the primordial element, the container of what the world and the psyche consists of before it becomes differentiated. This is the potential, or information. This is what attracts your attention unconsciously and compels you to attend to something before you know why it has gripped your interest. This is when and where what is new makes its entrance into what is predictable and certain, for better or worse. What flits about you with little voluntary control, as if it is something winged, as your imagination and your attention move unpredictably but meaningfully from association to association. And it is what you are looking at when you have no idea what it is that you are confronting. Finally, it is what you cannot look away from when you are possessed by horror, even as such potential for horror simultaneously adds vital interest to life. Strangely, the round chaos may be familiar to modern audiences, again, even if they do not know it, because of the Harry Potter series of books and films. J.K. Rowling, the series author, takes some pains to describe a sporting event, Quidditch, which helps to define and unify Hogwarts. The point of Quidditch is to drive a ball, the quaffle, through one of the 3 hoops guarded by the opposing team, while flying about the playing pitch on enchanted brooms. Success in doing so gains the scorer's team 10 points. Simultaneously, 2 separate players, 1 from each team, play another game, a game within the game. Chosen for their exceptional skill in attention and flight, these 2 competitors, known as seekers, attempt to locate, chase, and capture a winged ball, the snitch, which is identical in appearance to the round chaos that sits at the bottom of the alchemist's image. The snitch is golden, indicating its exceptional value and purity, and zips around chaotically at a very fast rate, darting, weaving, bobbing, and racing the seekers as they pursue it astride their brooms. If a seeker captures the snitch, his or her team gains 150 points, typically enough to ensure victory, and the entire game comes to an end. This indicates that chasing and capturing whatever is represented by the snitch, and by implication the round chaos, is a goal whose importance supersedes any other. Why is Rowling's game, conjured up for us by her deep imagination, structured in that manner? What does her narrative idea signify? There are 2 ways of answering these questions, although both answers relate importantly to each other. First, in Rule 1, we discuss the idea that the true winner of any game is the person who plays fair. This is because playing fair, despite the particularities of any given game, is a higher order accomplishment than mere victory. Striving to play fair in the ultimate sense, following the spirit of the rules as well as the letter, is an indication of true personality development, predicated as it is on concern for true reciprocity. The seekers of the snitch must ignore the details of the game of Quidditch, of which they are still a part, while attempting to find and seize the snitch, just as the player of a real-world game must ignore the particularities of that game while attending to what constitutes truly ethical play, regardless of what is happening on the playing field. Thus, the ethical player, like the seeker, indomitably pursues what is most valuable in the midst of complex competing obligations. Second, among the alchemists, the round chaos was associated with the winged god Mercury, who served as messenger from the realm of the divine, guide of souls to the underworld, and bringer of good fortune. It is for this reason that the ancient symbol for Mercury is located at the very pinnacle, the most important location, of the image in question. It is an attempt to indicate what guides the process that the picture represents. Centuries ago, prior to the dawn of modern chemistry, the god Mercury represented what inspires or attracts interest involuntarily. He was the spirit who possessed a person when his or her attention was drawn irresistibly to some person, situation, or event. Imagine that there are very complex processes going on in your mind unconsciously, highlighting events of potential worth and distinguishing them from everything else constantly unfolding around you. Imagine that those processes that distinguish value are alive, which is certainly the case, and that they are complex and integrated enough to be conceptualized as a personality. That is Mercury. The draw he exerts on our attention reveals itself in a sense of significance, in the sense that something happening around you is worth attending to or contains something of value. The seeker, in real life as well as in Rowling's Potter series and its Quidditch game, is he or she who takes that sense of significance more seriously than anything else. The seeker is therefore the person who is playing the game that everyone else is playing, and who is disciplined and expert at the game, but who is also playing an additional higher-order game, the pursuit of what is of primary significance. The snitch, like the round chaos, can therefore be considered the container of that primary significance, that meaning, and therefore something revelatory when pursued and caught. We might in this context remember what has come to be known as the Golden Rule. And as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. Luke 6:31. There is nothing more important than learning to strive under difficult and frustrating circumstances to play fair. This is what should be chased, so to speak, during any game, although it is also important to try to obtain victory in the game. Each of us, when fortunate, is compelled forward by something that grips our attention. Love of a person, a sport, a political, sociological, or economic problem, or scientific question, a passion for art, literature, or drama. Something that calls to us for reasons we can neither control nor understand. Try to make yourself interested in something you just do not care about and see how well that works. The phenomena that grip us, phenomena, from the Greek word phainesthai, to appear or to be brought to light, are like lamps along a dark path. They are part of the unconscious processes devoted to integrating and furthering the development of our spirits, the furtherance of our psychological development. You do not choose what interests you. It chooses you. Something manifests itself out of the darkness as compelling, as worth living for. Following that, something moves us further down the road to the next meaningful manifestation, and so it goes as we continue to seek, develop, grow, and thrive. It is a perilous journey, but it is also the adventure of our lives. Think of pursuing someone you love. Catch them or not, you change in the process. Think as well of the traveling you have done or of the work you have undertaken, whether for pleasure or necessity. In all these cases, you experience what is new. Sometimes that is painful. Sometimes it is better than anything else that has ever happened to you. Either way, it is deeply informative. It is all part of the potential of the world, calling you into being, changing you forever, for better or worse, in consequence of your pursuit. Atop the round chaos perches a dragon. This is because what is interesting and meaningful, and novel and unexpected, as those all go together, manifests itself in a form that is both dangerous and promising, particularly when its grip is intense and irresistible. The danger is, of course, signified by the presence of the immortal, predatory reptile. The promise is hinted at, as a dragon archetypally guards a great treasure. Thus, the drawing represents a psychological progression. First, you find yourself interested in something. That something, the round chaos, contains or is composed of potential or information. If it is pursued and caught, it releases that information. Out of that information, we build the world we perceive, and we build ourselves as perceivers. Thus, the round chaos is the container from which both matter, the world, and spirit, our psyches, emerge. There is some numerological indication of this on the spherical body of the round chaos itself. The number 3, accompanied by a triangle, which is traditionally associated with spirit because of its association with the Holy Trinity, and the number 4, associated with the world of matter because of its association with the four traditional elements, earth, water, wind, and fire. The dragon, in turn, perched on top of the round chaos, represents the danger and possibility of the information within. Atop the dragon stands a figure known as a rebus, a single body with two heads, one male, one female. The rebus is a symbol of the fully developed personality that can emerge from forthright and courageous pursuit of what is meaningful, the round chaos, and dangerous and promising, the dragon. It has a symbolically masculine aspect, which typically stands for exploration, order, and rationality, indicated by the sun, which can be seen to the left of the male head, and a symbolically feminine aspect, which stands for chaos, promise, care, renewal, and emotion, indicated by the moon, to the right of the female. In the course of normal socialization, it is typical for one of these aspects to become more developed than the other, as males are socialized in the male manner, to which they are also inclined biologically, and females in the female manner. Nonetheless, it is possible, with enough exploration, enough exposure to the round chaos and dragon, to develop both elements. That constitutes an ideal, or so goes the alchemical intuition. Out of the unknown, the potential that makes up the world, comes the terrible but promising form of the dragon, peril and promise united. It is an eternal dichotomy echoed by the presence of the two remaining symbols to the right and above the dragon's tail. Jupiter, representing the positive, and Saturn, the negative. Out of the confrontation with peril and promise emerges the masculine and feminine aspects of the psyche, working together in harmony. Guiding the process is the spirit Mercurius, manifesting itself as meaning in the world, working through unconscious means to attract exploration to what will unite the various discordant and warring elements of the personality. This can all be read, appropriately, as a story of the development of the ideal personality, an attempt in image to describe what each of us could be. Polytheism into monotheism, and the emergence of the virtuous hero. Who You Could Be, Part 2. Now we are going to attempt a description of who you could be from another perspective, taken from one of the earliest stories we have been fortunate enough to rediscover. In the ancient Mesopotamian Enuma Elish, translation, When on High, we have the oldest near-complete hero myth known, estimated at 4,000 years of age in its written form, and no doubt far older as an oral tradition. The story begins when the primordial goddess Tiamat, embodiment of salt water, as well as a monstrous aquatic dragon, enters into sexual union with her equally primordial male consort, Apsu, the embodiment of fresh water. This union gives rise to the initial realm of being, inhabited by the elder gods, the first children of Tiamat and Apsu. To understand the beginning of this story, we need to know a few things the ancients held to be fundamentally true. These are markedly different from the truths of modern science. Before the dawn of the scientific worldview, a mere 600 years ago, reality was construed as all that which human beings experience. That which we experience can be distinguished conceptually from reality as objective world, pure physical being, by its more comprehensive contents, which include subjective experiences such as emotions, dreams, visions, and motivational states such as hunger, thirst, and pain. That which we experience is better compared to a novel or a movie, which concentrates on the communication and sharing of subjective as well as objective states, than is reality as objective world, which we might liken to a scientific description of physical reality. It is the actual, particular, and unique demise of someone you love, for example, compared to the listing of that death in the hospital records. It is the drama of lived experience. It is because our own experience is genuinely literary, narrative, embodied, and story-like that we are so attracted to fictional representations. Movies, plays, operas, TV dramas, even the lyrics of songs help us deal with our lived experiences, which are something different and broader than the mere material from which our experience hypothetically rises. Engaging with the first part of the Enuma Elish requires us to understand a second fundamental realization of the ancients, the fundamentally social nature of our cognitive categories. That is why everything is personified in children's books: the sun, the moon, toys, animals, even machines. We see nothing strange in this because it so profoundly mirrors our perceptual tendencies. We expect children to view and understand the world in this manner, and we can easily fall back into doing so ourselves. Something should be clarified here. It is not truly accurate to state that the reality portrayed in children's fiction is personified. It is the case instead, and this is a genuine reversal of the presumption in question, that we directly and naturally perceive reality as personified, and then must work very diligently to strip that personification away so that we can detect objective reality. We understand reality, therefore, as if it is constructed of personalities. That is because so much of what we encounter in our hypersocial reality, our complex societies, is in fact personality, and gendered personality at that, reflecting the billion years or so since the emergence of sexual reproduction, ample time for its existence to have profoundly structured our perceptions. We understand male, and abstract from that, the masculine. We understand female, and abstract from that, the feminine. Finally, we understand the child, and abstract from that, most commonly, the son. These basic divisions are clearly reflected in the creation story of the Enuma Elish, just as they are reflected in, or more accurately underpin, our understanding of the stories we all know. Tiamat, the primordial goddess, is chaos, a female monster, a dragon. She is the terror of nature, creative and destructive, mother and slayer of us all. Apsu, her husband, is the eternal father. He is the order that we depend upon for security and by which we are simultaneously tyrannized. These two most primal of deities come together in a productive, sexual union, mingling their waters, in the ancient words. In this fashion, they produce their first progeny, the elder gods of Mesopotamia. These gods represent elements of the world more differentiated than the primordial mother and father, such as heaven and earth, mud and silt, and war and fire. However, they are also careless, noisy, and impulsive as two-year-old children, who are, after all, primal forces in their own right. Their continual, ceaseless, thoughtless activity and general unconsciousness culminates in a catastrophe. Their mutual decision to wage war upon and then slay Apsu, and consequent attempt to build a stable dwelling place on his corpse. Tiamat, chaos itself, already irritated by the brainless racket of her children, is murderously enraged by the heedless slaughter of her husband. The terrible goddess builds an army of 11 monsters to deal with her wayward offspring, placing a demonic figure named Kingu, whom she takes as a second husband, at their head, and delivering to him the Tablet of Destinies, indicating his authority as ultimate ruler of the universe. The relationship between this brilliant dramatic representation and how we use or misuse the gifts of our culture is obvious. The careless demolition of tradition is the invitation to the reemergence of chaos. When ignorance destroys culture, monsters will emerge. While Tiamat busily arranges her army, the elder gods continue their activity, pairing off, producing children, and then grandchildren of their own. One of the latter, Marduk, appears particularly talented, powerful, and promising. He is born with eyes encircling his head. He can see everywhere. He can speak magic words. He is something entirely new, and this is noted early by his progenitors. While Marduk matures, the elder gods are compelled to confront Tiamat, with whom they are now at war. One after another, they attempt to defeat her. All return an abject failure. Finally, someone suggests that Marduk, though still young, should be sent to confront his terrible grandmother. Approached with this idea, he agrees, but only on the condition that he is awarded the right, henceforth, if he is victorious, to hold the tablet of destinies and sit atop the dominance hierarchy of the gods. It is in this manner that this ancient story describes the emergence of monotheism out of polytheism. The Enuma Elish appears to be a dramatized account of the psychological or spiritual processes comprising this transformation. The ancient Mesopotamian civilization faced the necessity of incorporating and unifying many diverse tribes and peoples, each of whom had their own gods. The god who arose out of the conflict between all those gods, whose god is supreme, was, therefore, a meta-god, a god composed of what was most important about all gods. It was for such a reason, for example, that 50 different names characterized Marduk. This emergence of one from many is a very common process, described by the scholar of myth Mircea Eliade as the war of the gods in heaven, a typical mythological motif, as well as alluded to earlier. It is the psychological counterpart, in the world of imagination, to the genuine struggle of concepts of divinity and value on earth. Tribes unite. Each has its gods. The people comprising these multitudinous groups go to war, concretely and conceptually, for what they believe, sometimes for generations. It is as if the gods they follow were battling for dominance over periods exceeding single human lives, using their followers as proxies. That is reflected in the ancient stories. If and when the gods come to an agreement about their relative positions, more particularly if they arrange themselves into a hierarchy, it means that peace has genuinely been established, because peace is the establishment of a shared hierarchy of divinity, of value. Thus, an eternal question emerges whenever people of different backgrounds are required to deal with one another on a relatively permanent basis. What do all gods share that make them gods? What is God, in essence? That is a very difficult question. It is, on the one hand, the question of value. What is of the highest importance? It is, on the other hand, the question of sovereignty. What principle should rule? These are the questions posed by those pondering the ultimate source of divine significance itself. Their difficulty meant that they, and by extension the question of God, had to be answered over centuries, over millennia. The answer emerged first in story form. The Mesopotamians brilliantly intuited that the highest God, the highest good, involved careful attention, the multiple head-circling eyes of Marduk, and effective language, the magic words of Marduk, capable of generating a cosmos, in addition to the courage and strength to voluntarily confront and overcome chaos, the unknown. It could be argued that these are the defining features of the great central spirit of mankind, at least insofar as that spirit is noble and admirable. The ancient Egyptians formulated an idea similar in many important regards, which we will discuss later in detail. Associating their savior god Horus, son of Osiris, with the sharp-eyed falcon, and identifying him with the vision, willing to search out, detect, understand, and defeat evil, symbolized with the famous Egyptian image of the single eye. Representing that reality, pay attention, above all, even to what is monstrous and malevolent, and speak wisely and truthfully, could be the single most important accomplishment of our species. It allows us to apprehend, in dramatic form, the fundamental necessity of coming to grips with what our senses demonstrate to us, no matter how terrifying the reality revealed. It allows for the possibility of bringing our explicit understanding closer in line with our deepest being, making possible a truer union of body and spirit through the partial comprehension and imitation of the story. Most importantly, perhaps, it allows us to realize the immense importance of words in transforming potential into actuality, and helps us understand that the role we each play in that transformation is in some vital sense akin to the divine. After his election to the highest of places, Marduk challenges Tiamat directly, encloses her, defeated, in a giant net, and cuts her into pieces, fashioning the heavens and the earth from her remains. One of Marduk's many names is, in fact, He who makes ingenious things as a consequence of the conflict with Tiamat. It might be noted, in this regard, that tens of thousands of years ago, men literally did construct the habitable world out of the pieces of monsters, making their early dwellings from the giant bones of animals they had so courageously speared. Marduk simultaneously defeats his grandmother's monstrous army, including the leader, Kingu, from whom he takes the Tablet of Destinies, confirming his place as supreme leader of the cosmos. Then he returns home, enemies in tow. His compatriots celebrate his victory and accede yet more completely to his leadership before he assigns them their various duties. Then, after consulting Yi, the god of wisdom, Marduk determines to create man to aid the gods most fundamentally in the eternal task of maintaining the proper balance between order and chaos, to release those very gods from their service and to transfer their burden onto our all-too-human shoulders. The basic story is this. When order, Apsu, is carelessly threatened or destroyed, the terrible forces of chaos from which the world was originally derived appear once again in their most destructive, monstrous, predatory guise. Then a hero, representing the highest of values, must arise or be elected to confront this chaotic force. He does so successfully, deriving or producing something of great worth. What the hero represents is the most important of the great forces that make up the human psyche. To think of it another way, the hero is the embodied principle of action and perception that must rule over all the primordial psychological elements of lust, rage, hunger, thirst, terror, and joy. For chaos to remain effectively at bay, or even better, tamed and therefore harnessed, this heroic principle must be regarded as the most important of all things that can organize and motivate mankind. This means at least that it must be continually acted out, which is what regarded as important actually means. It is in this way that the spirit of Marduk still possesses each individual who engages courageously in the processes of encounter and confrontation that eternally create and renew society. It is this that happens when each small child learns to regulate and unite his emotions and motivations into a coherent personality and then goes out to challenge the unknown world. In slightly altered form, this is the story of Saint George. The inhabitants of an ancient city must obtain water from a well beside the nest of a dragon. To do so, however, they have to offer the dragon some sacrifice, a sheep under most circumstances, but a maiden if no sheep can be found. The young women of the city draw lots when the supply of sheep is exhausted. One day it is the daughter of the king herself who loses. Saint George appears, confronts the dragon with the sign of the cross, symbol of the eternal redeemer, the archetypal hero, and frees the doomed princess. The city's inhabitants then convert to Christianity. Victory over the dragon, the predator as such, the ruler of unexplored territory, is victory over all the forces that have threatened the individual and society, over evolutionary and historical spans of time, as well as the more abstract evil we all still face, without and within. The cross, for its part, is the burden of life. It is a place of betrayal, torture, and death. It is therefore a fundamental symbol of mortal vulnerability. In the Christian drama, it is also the place where vulnerability is transcended as a consequence of its acceptance. This voluntary acceptance is also equivalent to victory over the dragon, representation of chaos, death, and the unknown. By accepting life's suffering, therefore, evil may be overcome. The alternative is hell, at least in its psychological form, rage, resentment, and the desire for revenge and destruction. The same story is echoed in the tales of St. Patrick, who chases the snakes out of Ireland, and St. Michael, who defeats the Christian equivalent of Kingu, that ancient serpent called the devil, Revelation 12:9. This is the same story recounted by J.R.R. Tolkien in The Hobbit, which was in turn derived from the ancient poem Beowulf, the tale of a hero defeating a pair of intelligent monsters, son, and then worse, mother. In The Hobbit, the hero develops character and wisdom, as a thief, strangely enough, during his quest to help discover the ancient treasure hoarded by the dragon. The story of Perseus and Medusa, whose visage was so terrible that it turned onlookers to stone, is another variant, as is Pinocchio, who rescues his father from a subaquatic monster and dies and is reborn while doing so. Something similar is portrayed in the first of the recent Avengers movies, in which Iron Man, the man who has transformed himself into a partly golden superhero, defeats the alien dragon worms of the Chitauri, allied with the satanic Loki. He then dies, is reborn, and gets the maiden, in the non-swooning guise of Ms. Pepper Potts. It must be understood. Such stories would not even be comprehensible, not least to children as well as adults, if our evolutionary history had importantly differed, and if our entire culture had not been shaped, implicitly and explicitly, by these ancient patterns. All these heroes act out what was perhaps the greatest discovery ever made by man's primordial ancestors. If you have the vision and the courage, and a good stout stick when necessary, you can chase away the worst of snakes. No doubt the greatest of our ancestors were beginning to threaten snakes with sticks when we still lived in trees. No doubt it was those voluntarily snake-chasing ancestors who reaped the benefits of their bravery in the form of nearby grateful maidens or their ancestral arboreal equivalents, and perhaps this is why dragons hoard virgins as well as gold. What constitutes the worst of all snakes and the stoutest of all sticks, however, might be regarded as the central religious questions of humanity. It is interesting to note that in The Hobbit, the worst snake is only a dragon, but in The Lord of the Rings, the worst snake, so to speak, is the much more abstract evil of the wizard Sauron. As humanity became more sophisticated in its capacity to abstract, we increasingly appreciated the fact that predatory monsters can come in many guises, only some of which are animal in their form. Literature of an arguably more sophisticated form endlessly echoes this realization. Hero, Dragon, Death and Rebirth. Who You Could Be. Part 3. In the second volume of J.K. Rowling's fantasy series, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, the castle of Hogwarts is threatened by strange, chaotic forces due to the earlier and ongoing misbehavior of several powerful adult wizards, as established in Volume 1. Now, it is significant that Harry is orphaned. It is an integral part of the heroic pattern. He has his earthly parents, the thick and conventional Dursleys, willfully blind, short-sighted, and terribly overprotective of, and therefore tragically dangerous to Dudley, their unfortunate but predictably self-centered and bullying natural son. But Harry has his heavenly parents, too, his true mother and father. Symbolically, nature and culture, variants of chaos and order. They exist as part of his intrinsically magical potential, the magical potential of all of us, in fact, as we are all children of nature and culture, with the tremendous potential that implies, as well as the more mundane offspring of our particular parents. When Harry returns to Hogwarts after his summer vacation, he can detect strange and ominous noises emanating from somewhere in the building. At the same time, various students and residents of Hogwarts are found paralyzed, turned to stone, in diverse locations around the building. Turned to stone. What could that possibly mean? It certainly means to be unable to move, but it also signifies something deeper. It means to be hunted, to become a rabbit confronted by a wolf, to become the horrified and awestruck object of the predatory gaze. Many herbivores, comparatively defenseless, facing imminent and brutal death, freeze in place, paralyzed by fear, depending on camouflage and immobility to render them invisible to the terrible intentions of nearby red-toothed and razor-clawed carnivores. Predatory reptilian forms still particularly have that effect on human beings, hence our odd fascination, for example, with dinosaurs. But to have no more courage than a rabbit is definitely not to be everything you could be. Eventually, Harry learns that the force turning his friends into stone is a gigantic snake, a basilisk, whose gaze exerts a paralyzing force. He discovers that this serpent is continually slithering around the very foundation of Hogwarts in the immense waterworks that serve the great castle. This basilisk is an analog to the great dragon faced by Beowulf hero of the thousand-year-old story that served as pattern for Tolkien's adventures, perhaps the 20th century's closest cousins to J.K. Rowling's extensive fantasy. It is as well the great devouring shark of the movie Jaws, lurking in the black water of night, ready at a moment's notice to pull the naked and unwary below. The fragility of our homes and our institutions, which can collapse and leave us stripped of their protective walls in a single terrible moment. And, more comprehensively, the underworld of the ancients, whose doors gape open when everything predictable collapses. At the deepest of levels, this is the chaos and potential that continually lurks under the order of our familiar worlds, psychological and social. After much searching, Harry gains entrance to this underworld labyrinth of pipes and tunnels and finds the central chamber. He does this, significantly, through the sewer, acting out the ancient alchemical dictum, in sterquilinus invenatur, in filth it will be found. What does this mean? That which you most need to find will be found where you least wish to look. There, underground, Ginny, Virginia, his best friend's sister and Harry's eventual serious romantic interest, lies unconscious. She is the maiden, or the anima, the soul, forever incarcerated by the dragon, as in the tale of St. George. It is up to Harry, orphaned hero, to wake and rescue her, just as Tolkien's Bilbo helps take the gold from the terrible Smaug, just as Disney's Prince Philip rescues Sleeping Beauty, both rescuing what is most valuable from the clutches of a great dragon. And of course, the unknown is a great predator, the basilisk Harry faces. And of course that predator guards a great treasure, gold beyond measure or the sleeping virgin. Because the individual brave enough to voluntarily beard the serpent in his lair is most likely to gain access to the untold riches that exist in potential, awaiting us in the adventure of our life, away from security and what is currently known. Who dares wins, if he does not perish? And who wins also makes himself irresistibly desirable and attractive, not least because of the development of character that adventure inevitably produces. And this is what makes us forever more than rabbits. And Harry, like Bilbo, can only manage this, can only perceive the serpent when it is invisible to everyone else, because he has a dark side. Tolkien's Bilbo must become a thief before he can become a hero. He must incorporate his monstrousness so that he can supersede his naive harmlessness before he is tough enough to face the terrors that confront him. Harry is touched by evil in another manner, as part of the incomparably dark wizard Voldemort's soul is embedded within him, although neither he nor Voldemort are initially aware of this. It is for this reason that the young wizard can speak with and hear, that is, perceive, snakes. It is in keeping with this that he is disciplined and courageous, but also willing and ready to break the rules when necessary. While in the bowels of Hogwarts, Harry comes under attack by the basilisk, which is under the control of Voldemort. Voldemort therefore bears the same relationship to the basilisk in Hogwarts as Satan does, strangely and incomprehensibly, to the vision-granting serpent in the Genesis story of the Garden of Eden. Why might this be? It could be said, and should be, that one form of serpentine chaos and danger is the threat of the reptilian predator itself. But another form, more abstract, more psychological, more spiritual, is human evil, the danger we pose to one another. At some point in our evolutionary and cultural history, we began to understand that human evil could rightly be considered the greatest of all snakes. So, the symbolic progression might be 1. Snake as evil predator. Then 2. External human enemy as snake, evil, predator. Then 3. Subjective, personal, or psychological darkness, vengefulness, deceit as snake, evil, predator. Each of these representations, which took untold centuries, perhaps millennia, to conceptualize, constitute a tangible increase in the sophistication of the image of evil. All such manifestations of serpentine chaos and danger are apparently still first detected, processed, and symbolically interassociated by the ancient brain systems that evolved to protect us from predatory reptiles. And freezing, prompted by those systems, solves the problem now, maybe, by hiding the individual who is currently being preyed upon, but it leaves the predator alive for tomorrow. Instead, the danger must be hunted down and destroyed. And even that is too concrete to constitute a permanent solution to the problem of evil itself, rather than a solution to any particular exemplar of evil. Most profoundly and abstractly, paralleling the idea that the greatest predator, the greatest snake, is the evil that lurks within, evil's destruction manifests as the life of virtue that constrains malevolence in its most abstracted and comprehensive form. It is for this reason, for example, that the Disney Prince Philip of Sleeping Beauty fame is armed for his conflict with the great dragon of chaos by benevolent nature, in the form of the feminine fairies that accompany him and aid in his escape from Maleficent, the evil queen, with the sword of truth and shield of virtue. Harry directly confronts the basilisk, down in the Chamber of Secrets, deep below the wizarding castle, but is cornered and in great peril. At that propitious moment, a phoenix kept by the wise headmaster of Hogwarts arrives, provides the young hero with a sword, and then attacks the giant snake, providing Harry with time to regroup. Harry slays the basilisk with the weapon, but is fatally bitten in the process. This is another deep mythological echo. In the story of Genesis, for example, the encounter with the snake proves fatal to man and woman alike, who become aware of their fragility and inevitable death soon after they awaken and gain vision. It is also a harsh truth. Predators devour, dragons lay waste, chaos destroys. The threat is real. Even truth, virtue, and courage are not necessarily enough, but they are our best bet. And sometimes a little death is the medication necessary to forestall death itself. Fortunately, the phoenix has magical revivifying tears, which it cries into Harry's wounds. Thus, the young wizard revives, defeats Voldemort, a much more challenging task than merely overcoming the gargantuan serpent, rescues Ginny, and saves the school. It is with the introduction of the phoenix to the story of St. George that Rowling reveals another element of her intuitive genius. The phoenix is a fowl that can die and be reborn forever. It has, therefore, throughout the ages, been a symbol of Christ, with whom the magical bird shares many features. It is also, equally, that element of the individual human personality that must die and regenerate as it learns, painfully, through the oft-tragic experience that destroys previous certainty, replacing it first with doubt, and then, when successfully confronted, with new and more complete knowledge. A voluntary death and rebirth transformation, the change necessary to adapt when terrible things emerge, is therefore a solution to the potentially fatal rigidity of erroneous certainty, excessive order, and stultification. How to act. People exchange information about how to act in many ways. They observe each other and imitate what they see. When they imitate, they use their bodies to represent the bodies of others. But this imitation is not mindless, automatized mimicry. It is instead the ability to identify regularities or patterns in the behavior of other people, and then to imitate those patterns. When a young girl plays at being a mother, for example, she does not duplicate, gesture for gesture, what she has previously observed of her mother's actions. Instead, she acts as if she were a mother. If you ask the girl what she is doing, she will tell you that she is pretending to be a mother. But if you get her to describe what that means, particularly if she is a young child, her description will be far less complete than her actions would indicate. This means she can act out more than she can say, just as we all can. If you observed many little girls acting out many mothers, you could derive a very good idea of what mother meant in its purest form, even if you had never seen an actual mother. If you were good with words, then perhaps you could describe the essential elements of maternal behavior and transmit them. You might do that best in the form of a story. It is easier and more direct to represent a behavioral pattern with behavior than with words. Outright mimicry does that directly, action for action. Imitation, which can produce new behaviors akin to those that motivated the mimicry, takes that one step further. Drama, formalized imitation, enacted upon a stage, is precisely behavior portraying behavior, but distilled ever closer to the essence. Literature takes that transmission one more difficult step, portraying action in the imagination of the writer and reader, in the complete absence of both real actors and a material stage. It is only the greatest of storytellers who can manage that transformation, representing the greatest and most vitally necessary of acts in the most interesting, profound, and memorable words. Generations of great storytellers, retelling, modifying, and editing great stories, therefore end up jointly creating the greatest of stories. Once cultures become literate, something that has happened only recently from the historical perspective, those stories can be written down. It is at this point, roughly, that myth and ritual might be said to transform themselves into religion. The imitation and communication of the greatest, most memorable acts necessitates distillation and communication of the patterns of the deepest wisdom of mankind. If a great and memorable act is one undertaken by a particularly admirable individual, a local hero, then the greatest and most memorable acts possible would be those undertaken by the spirit, embodied in part by particular individuals, who exemplified what all local heroes everywhere have in common. That hero of heroes, that meta-hero, would have to exist, logically, in turn, in a place that was common across all places, requiring heroism. That place might be regarded as a meta-world, even though it is real, even hyper-real. That is, more real in its abstraction across places than our direct perceptions of a given, singular time or place. It is precisely this hyper-real meta-world that consists of the continual interactions between chaos and order, which eternally serve as the battleground between good and evil characterizing the hero. The undying pattern that hero embodies, in turn, upon whose actions the individual and society both depend, is the highest of all gods. He is both child of and mediator between those twin forces, transforming chaos into habitable order, as well as recasting order into chaos so that it can be renewed when it has become anachronistic and corrupt, as well as battling mightily so that good might prevail. Everyone requires a story to structure their perceptions and actions in what would otherwise be the overwhelming chaos of being. Every story requires a starting place that is not good enough and an ending place that is better. Nothing can be judged in the absence of that end place, that higher value. Without it, everything sinks into meaninglessness and boredom, or degenerates and spirals into terror, anxiety, and pain. But, as time changes all things inexorably, every specific value-predicated story may fail in its particular incarnation and locale and need replacement by something newer, more complete, but different. In consequence, the actor of a given story, and therefore someone deeply affiliated with the plot and the characterization, still must bow to the spirit of creative transformation that originally created and may need to destroy and recreate that story. It is for this reason that spirit eternally transcends dogma, truth transcends presupposition, Marduk transcends the elder gods, creativity updates society, and Christ transcends the law, as does Harry Potter, along with his courageous but continually rule-breaking friends. But it is important to remember, as we discussed in Rule 1, Those who break the rules ethically are those who have mastered them first and disciplined themselves to understand the necessity of those rules and break them in keeping with the spirit rather than the letter of the law. The second volume of Rowling's series proposes that predatory evil can be overcome by the soul willing to die and be reborn. The complete series ends with a creatively transformed repetition of the same message. The analogy with Christianity is obvious, and the message, in essence, the same. The soul willing to transform as deeply as necessary is the most effective enemy of the demonic serpents of ideology and totalitarianism in their personal and social forms. The healthy, dynamic, and above all else, truthful personality will admit to error. It will voluntarily shed, let die, outdated perceptions, thoughts, and habits as impediments to its further success and growth. This is the soul that will let its old beliefs burn away, often painfully, so that it can live again and move forward, renewed. This is also the soul that will transmit what it has learned during that process of death and rebirth, so that others can be reborn along with it. Aim at something. Pick the best target you can currently conceptualize. Stumble toward it. Notice your errors and misconceptions along the way. Face them and correct them. Get your story straight. Past, present, future, they all matter. You need to map your path. You need to know where you were so that you do not repeat the mistakes of the past. You need to know where you are, or you will not be able to draw a line from your starting point to your destination. You need to know where you are going, or you will drown in uncertainty, unpredictability, and chaos, and starve for hope and inspiration. For better or worse, you are on a journey. You are having an adventure, and your map better be accurate. Voluntarily confront what stands in your way. The way. That is the path of life, the meaningful path of life, the straight and narrow path that constitutes the very border between order and chaos, and the traversing of which brings them into balance. Aim at something profound and noble and lofty. If you can find a better path along the way, once you have started moving forward, then switch course. Be careful, though. It is not easy to discriminate between changing paths and simply giving up. One hint, if the new path you see forward after learning what you needed to learn along your current way appears more challenging, then you can be reasonably sure that you are not deluding or betraying yourself when you change your mind. In this manner, you will zigzag forward. It is not the most efficient way to travel, but there is no real alternative, given that your goals will inevitably change while you pursue them, as you learn what you need to learn while you are disciplining yourself. You will then find yourself turning across time, incrementally and gracefully, to aim ever more accurately at that tiny pinpoint, the X that marks the spot, the bullseye, and the center of the cross, to aim at the highest value of which you can conceive. You will pursue a target that is both moving and receding. Moving because you do not have the wisdom to aim in the proper direction when you first take aim. Receding because no matter how close you come to perfecting what you are currently practicing, new vistas of possible perfection will open up in front of you. Discipline and transformation will nonetheless lead you inexorably forward. With will and luck, you will find a story that is meaningful and productive, improves itself with time, and perhaps even provides you with more than a few moments of satisfaction and joy. With will and luck, you will be the hero of that story, the disciplined sojourner, the creative transformer, and the benefactor of your family and broader society. Imagine who you could be, and then aim single-mindedly at that.